regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking about an unfree state on the show here. Attorney Dan Hagen is going to be with us from Massachusetts. He is the attorney representing Kyle Culotta. We've talked about Kyle's case several times here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. He is the Air Force veteran who, along with his girlfriend, they lived in Arizona. They were making their way to his girlfriend's family's home there in New England, I think New Hampshire, essentially living out of their car, making money, door dashing as they drove across the country. They're in Massachusetts. They get pulled over for traffic violation. I think it was an expired tag or expired expansion stick or something like that. The officer says, we're going to tow the vehicle. Get anything out of the car that that you want because I'm taking it away. Kyle says, all right, well, I've got some guns and ammunition in there. And that's when Kyle was taken into custody, charged with illegally possessing firearms, large capacity magazines. He was deemed dangerous by a court, even though he had no criminal record, was charged with mere possessory offenses. And under Massachusetts dangerousness statute, once a judge says you're dangerous, you can be held without bond for up to 120 days. And that is how long Kyle Culotta spent behind bars before he was allowed to bail out. Even though during that time period, Dan Hagen was able to get some of the most serious charges against Culotta dropped, he was still deemed dangerous. During that same time period, we saw somebody in Boston who was charged with shooting at a vehicle in which a pregnant woman was inside, not be deemed dangerous. They were allowed out. And after Kyle was released in late October, this, I wrote about this earlier today, an aide to Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey was busted on charges of cocaine trafficking and illegal gun possession. He was initially deemed dangerous, but a Superior Court judge reversed that decision, and Lamar Cook was able to bond out earlier this week. So, I mean, you can shoot at somebody and not be dangerous, or you can be accused of shooting at somebody and not be dangerous. You can be accused of trafficking in cocaine and not be deemed dangerous. But if you're from out of state and you're caught in Massachusetts with guns that are legally owned where you live, but you don't have that Massachusetts-issued permission slip, you can be deemed dangerous, and you can be held without bond. As you'll hear from Dan, this law is pretty subjective. It's not that everybody charged with a mere possessory offense is deemed dangerous, but that is an option. And more importantly, as Dan tells me, it seems like prosecutors in Massachusetts are really intent right now on going after any non-resident they can who would dare exercise or dare try or even think that they've got a right to keep and bear arms in Massachusetts without that Massachusetts-issued permission slip. Take a look and a listen. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to meet you, sir. I'm really pleased that we could do this today.
Absolutely, Cam. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, we've been, you know, hearing your name a lot every time we talk with Jim Wallace. We hear the latest from Attorney Dan Hagen. So, first of all, thank you for what you're doing in Massachusetts. I'm just curious. I mean, how much of your practice these days is Second Amendment related or related to Massachusetts gun laws?
So a substantial part of my practice is, so what I do is both the criminal gun cases, so folks that run afoul of the Massachusetts gun laws in a criminal context, but also licensing cases, because here in Massachusetts, we're not a shall issue state. As much as the Mass Supreme Court wants to call us a shall issue state, you know, just because you're not a federally prohibited person, you can be denied a license in Massachusetts, and the police have a tremendous amount of discretion in the form of suitability, where they can say, we know something about you. You've never been committed, you know, convicted of a crime, but we know something about you. And, you know, we don't feel that you're suitable to have a gun. You could be a threat to public safety. And so they deny people, a lot of people, licenses here in the state. And so I do a sizable chunk of defending those folks too.
Is that an issue you think that is ultimately going to reach the Supreme Court? Because again, in Bruin, you know, they talked about shall issue systems, right? And they even discussed, I think, some of these states where they said, okay, there might be, you know, I don't think the word was suitability, but there might be, you know, some states where the language appears to offer some discretion, but in practice, it's really shall issue. That again may be what the Massachusetts court says, but that's not what the reality is. So, do you think there will be an opportunity for the Supreme Court to hear or address this issue at some point in the future?
Sure. Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, the way the statutes are written in Massachusetts is there is really not clear definition around, you know, what is not a suitable person. They just say could be maybe a threat to public safety. Well, that's very wide open, and there's not sufficient guardrails. Now, could suitability in some form pass constitutional muster? I don't know, but certainly what Massachusetts is doing, I don't see how that does just the wide open discretion that they've given the police. And it gets worse than that, because when we go to court on a license to carry, we actually carry the burden, which is shocking to me. The police don't have to show, it's not their burden to show that you are a threat to public safety. You have a burden to show that the police are being unreasonable in their determination that you are a threat. So you bear the burden of proof. So even if a judge says, you know, 5149, I'd give him the license, you know, that's not enough. The judge has to say the police are acting unreasonably. Now, what other constitutional right is treated like that? And I have cases pending challenging that here in the state of Massachusetts. And I said, that is something that at some point has to be changed. I mean, we cannot have a system where you are supposedly clothed with this constitutional right, but then yet you get to bear the burden to somehow establish what should have already been established.
Yeah, that is all right. That's crazy. We're going to talk more about that in a future conversation. I've got to ask as well. How is your client Kyle Culotta doing these days? I know he is finally out of jail after spending the full 120 days allowed under Massachusetts dangerousness statute. He was finally allowed to post bail. How is he doing?
So he's doing well. There's an acclimation process. You know, obviously this was a whirlwind event that happened to him. You know, came into the state and didn't realize he was going to spend the next several months in jail. So he's acclimating, but certainly happy to be out, happy for his freedom. He's thankful to everyone who supported him. You know, I know you've mentioned his case and Goal and many others. So he's very thankful for that. And, you know, what happened to Kyle, though, unfortunately, is not all that unusual here in the state of Massachusetts. And, you know, the whole idea of you being able to be held for 120 days, that is right in the Massachusetts statute, that with simple possession of a firearm, no violence, no aggression. I mean, he was cooperative with the police. You're talking about a decorated Air Force veteran. You can be held pending trial. And in 120 days, they can't hold you past that except for good cause. But routinely, prosecutors ask to renew the 120-day, you know, they can extend dangerousness. So we were able to, you know, get the dangerousness determination ended and ultimately get him bail. And so, you know, he's happy, but we're still fighting because it's not over.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you talk about the subjective nature of the licensing process. It seems like the dangerousness determination is also pretty subjective because, you know, this was a different judge. I think it was even a different county. But while Kyle was in jail, there was a guy in Boston, I believe, who was arrested and charged for shooting at a car. The pregnant woman was inside. This was sort of a road rage incident. Mm-hmm. He was deemed not dangerous. He was allowed to post bail very quickly. We just saw former aide to Governor Maura Healey, who was arrested late last month, charged with illegal gun possession and trafficking cocaine. He was initially declared dangerous, but a Superior Court judge reversed that decision. He's now out on bail after, I think, you know, maybe 2 weeks behind bars. So this too, again, there's a lot of discretion going on in the court system as to who exactly is dangerous.
That's right. If Kyle only trafficked 21 kilos of cocaine, you know, okay, I mean, you know, maybe like the governor's aide did. No, what with Kyle's situation though, it's, you know, it is judge by judge and case by case. That is unfortunately what a defendant faces here in Massachusetts. So there, I think Kyle, if he was in front of a more reasonable judge, certainly would have, this would not have been the case. But we leave it open to the judge's discretion and the prosecutor's discretion, by the way. The prosecutors they don't have to move for dangerousness in all situations. And you will talk about that in a minute, but they're supposed to be finding by clear and convincing evidence. I mean, almost proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, it's very high up. The standard is very high. It has to be clear and convincing evidence that you both are a danger and, two, that there's no conditions of release that can ensure the safety of the community. I mean, how you get there with Kyle, I don't understand, and I will never understand how you can say clear and convincing evidence. I mean, the only thing the judges noted was, well, he had, you know, several guns. Okay, well, that's the offense. I mean, that's fine. But he didn't just have guns. You know, he had all of his worldly possessions, the car he was moving. So it wasn't like it was some, didn't look nefarious in any way.
Right.
He said his ties to Arizona. Well, I mean, okay, it's another state in our union. So I don't know. It's troubling. It's shocking. And I blame the prosecutors too, because they have, as I said, the discretion whether to move for dangerousness or not. And they're using a one size fits all policy, both in moving for dangerousness and also in charging people who come in from out of state. So a person like Kyle comes in from out of state without a license, several exceptions he might fall into in Massachusetts, but the prosecutor still charges you with felonies, which carry mandatory minimum jail time, which even a judge can't go below. The statute says you must serve at least 18 months mandatory minimum on a simple possession of a firearm charge, and it's a felony. And then the prosecutor has the ability to move for dangerousness, and they're not differentiating between folks here in this state who have a lengthy criminal record. They're not moving for dangerousness just against them, but also the poor guy that comes over the border by a couple of miles unknowingly, or maybe reads an exception in the law and thinks, oh, I'm okay, but they don't realize that these exceptions are things that you have to establish at trial. They're not things that the government necessarily has to disprove. So I blame the prosecutors as well as the judges for a lot of these and the law, obviously, for a lot of these things happening.
So I mean, let's talk about how common this is becoming, because, yeah, I was born in Massachusetts, but I moved when I was a kid, still have family up there. And, you know, I mean, I lived in northern Massachusetts, you know, Haverhill area, Andover area. You drive 20 minutes, you're in New Hampshire, right? In southern Massachusetts, you can drive 15 minutes, you're in Connecticut or Rhode Island. I mean, it's a pretty small state. It's pretty easy to cross the border. And right. You've got a lot of folks who will do that, right? New Hampshire residents will drive over to Massachusetts, do some shopping, visit family. Same thing, you know, I guess with the Connecticut residents, Rhode Islanders. It would be so easy to accidentally even make a wrong turn, and all of a sudden you end up in Massachusetts, right?
That's correct.
So is this an issue that you are seeing more of? I mean, do you think are prosecutors like trying to, I don't want to say go after non-residents, but are they trying to make an example of non-residents who are carrying in Massachusetts without that Massachusetts issued permission slip?
Sure. Well, I do think the prosecutors are applying a one size fits all policy. So that's what I'm saying, is they're not accounting for that, you know, that situation. And yes, you're correct. I mean, the state borders surrounding Massachusetts, there's not a lot of distance between, you know, states here in New England. You know, you go out west, you've got to go a long way before you cross a state border sometimes. But here, you know, we jump over state borders, you know, fairly regularly. And yeah, I've seen it here in Massachusetts regularly. We get, you know, just in the last week, we've got a couple of more cases, unfortunately, similar to Kyle's, where people come in unknowingly out of state, didn't realize the need for a... The draconian firearms laws here in Massachusetts, and end up running into you know, some serious problems. Remember, it's not just like a slap on the wrist. This is a felony conviction, which changes your life. They don't understand, you know, that being, you know, people don't understand. You know, you get a felony conviction, it's hard to find work. You know, you lose civil rights. I mean, there's all kinds of things that come with a felony conviction, and you have to spend time in jail. So imagine somebody who's an otherwise law-abiding person made a mistake and came over the border by a couple of miles, is now facing that. And I think a corollary to this is, you know, a non-resident license here in Massachusetts, and I know you've, I think you've talked to both Jim Wallace and Mike Harris about this, that the time frames to get a non-resident license is, I've been hearing horror stories upwards to a year. So, I mean, that is, you know, that is unacceptable for some. So you can't just get a license within a matter of days or weeks. I mean, this is, you have to, you know, apply well in advance to just go over the border by a couple of miles. It really makes no sense. And I think it begs the question, what other constitutional right stops at a state border?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is a question here. And correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the non-resident permit require you to do an in-person visit at some point?
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, which again, is just another burden on the applicant here, right? And I mean, if I were to, again, if I wanted to carry when I go visit family in Massachusetts, I got to make an extra trip to the state of Massachusetts just so I can go talk to the police so I can exercise fundamental civil right. Because otherwise, again, as you say, you're looking at a felony charge, right? You're looking at mandatory prison time. You're looking about your life changing.
Correct.
One of these cases, I don't know how much you can get into, but as I understand it, this individual was actually arrested at the hospital.
Yeah. So, okay. So what you're talking about is a new case that I've had come in the last week and a half or so. And this is a lady who is was a nurse. She's a nurse been a nurse for 18 years, law-abiding person, not a federally prohibited person, has a firearm for self-defense, had come over a state border here in Massachusetts, was traveling within the state, I think falls into our exception here, which is the only slight bright spot of Chapter 135 is that there is an exception for folks passing through Massachusetts, non-residents, to be able to, while in the vehicle, possess a firearm. But in any event, she gets into a car accident here in Springfield. Not her fault. Someone blew through a red light at an intersection, and she was hit and run. So the person took off. So she's in a neck brace in the hospital when the police search her car as part of an inventory search. And as sadly happens here in Massachusetts, the police quickly turn the victim into the perpetrator and charge her with unlicensed possession of a firearm. And because the firearm was loaded, they also charged her with an enhancement of having a loaded firearm, which carries on and after jail time for her. So that's how they treat her. I mean, she's a 39-year-old, single mother, two-time cancer survivor. It's shocking, and but you know that's the state we live in behind the Iron Curtain here.
Yeah, and which again, when we go back to prosecutor discretion, right? The prosecutor did not have to file those charges. Even if the police, I mean, you could argue the police didn't have to, police have discretion not to arrest her on those charges, but prosecution certainly has the ability to say, look, this is inappropriate given the circumstances here. They haven't done that.
They have not yet done that. I mean, she actually, we're just starting the process with her. So, you know, I'm hopeful the prosecutor, you know, I'm going to make a play for them to see if they can kind of see it the way that I think most reasonable people would view this or should view this.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, it's hard to say again, and we've just had, again, that one size fits all policy. It's been very hard to get prosecutors to come off these mandatory minimums. And that's unfortunate. I mean, I even had another case, this wrapped up a few months ago, but a gentleman, he was 65 years old, lived in Vermont. Okay. Was traveling on an interstate highway, Interstate 91, which travels, you know, which goes through Massachusetts up into Vermont. And he was pulled over and found to have so-called large capacity magazines. Everyone else knows them as standard capacity magazines, but he had large capacity magazines, which are felonies here in Massachusetts. He was indicted into Superior Court, no firearms, just the magazine. And they wanted to put him in jail. 65-year-old man who had essentially no criminal record, was a grandfather. I mean, so that is the one size fits all nature. I was able to have him avoid jail time, you know, and was able to get him a good outcome. But boy, I'll tell you, it took several lawyers and a few years in order for that to occur. So yeah, it's not good here in Massachusetts.
It is not. Was the woman who was in the car accident in Springfield, did they try to go after her for dangerousness?
They haven't yet. So what happened was they charged her. I've put off because I got involved. So I've put off her arraignment. They can move for it. But I think it's hard because at this point, you know, time has elapsed. She wasn't brought right in. So I'm hopeful, you know, I'm going to be speaking with the prosecutors to hope they don't try to move for dangerousness in her situation. But they certainly are free to. I mean, that's within the statute, you know.
So besides stay away, what is your advice for non-resident gun owners, Dan?
Yeah, it's tough, Cam, because like I said, even if you fall into an exception here in the state, that does not mean that they can't arrest you. And then it is on us to establish that at trial. So, you know, there's exceptions in Massachusetts. For example, if you're moving here as a new resident, you have 60 days to get an LTC. The problem is if you're arrested in that time frame, it's on you at your trial to essentially establish that you are a new resident. And then the Commonwealth has to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So, you know, I think people have to be exceptionally careful coming in here from out of state. I think the obviously if to get a non-resident license, I mean, I think you have to kind of go through that maze for the time being just to be safe. And I try to give everyone the most conservative advice I can because I don't want to see them be the guinea pig. You know, I don't want to see them, become a felon and sit in jail as an otherwise good person. So I don't really have a lot of great advice other than I think you've got to try to get a non-resident license or avoid bringing the firearm in the state unless you are, you know, clearly in an exception that, you know, you're willing to potentially, you know, have to fight a little bit to establish it.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, if we have some sort of national right to carry reciprocity, that could probably solve a lot of these issues. We've got H.R. 38 in Congress. I think the House is probably going to be holding a vote on that in the next couple of weeks. I don't know what the prospects are in the Senate, honestly, whether it could get 60 votes. That's maybe a stretch. And we're just starting to fight these fights in the court system. Right. I know that, for instance, out in California, there was a challenge to California did not even have a non-resident permit. There was no way for non-residents to legally carry in the state. There is now a way for non-residents to apply for a California permit. Again, it is, I think, unreasonable to expect non-residents to go through that process, just like I think it's unreasonable to expect non-residents to go through the Massachusetts process. Mm-hmm. But these things are you know, just starting. I mean, they are starting to be litigated, right? So there is an opportunity for the courts to intervene and apply some common sense going forward.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think legislatively, as long as the filibuster stands, which I know there is some talk now of potentially doing away with the filibuster, so maybe our prospects will change. But I mean, while the filibuster is in place, I think national reciprocity is something that's out of reach for us legislatively. However, there is the potential for like a backdoor judicial reciprocity in involving cases like these that are coming into Massachusetts, you know, out-of-state residents, and establishing that your Second Amendment rights don't stop at a state border. There's actually a case up there right now pending cert with the Supreme Court, a Commonwealth versus Marquis case, which went to the Mass Supreme Court where they upheld, you know, our gun laws to out-of-state residents who simply cross the border. It was a bad decision. But I am hopeful if the U.S. Supreme Court took that up, I think they would establish that no other constitutional right stops the state border. You're legal in your home state. You're a lawful gun owner. You're not federally prohibited. Simply crossing a state border should not suddenly strip you of those rights. I mean, your First Amendment rights don't go away. Your Fourth Amendment rights don't go away. How can your Second Amendment rights go away once you cross the state border? So that would be a backdoor kind of judicial reciprocity if we could get a case up there and get the Supreme Court to take it, which is a tall order, but I mean, we have to try all avenues.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, unfortunately, if it's not Marquis, there are going to be a lot of other cases waiting in the wings. And who knows, maybe one of your clients and maybe you one day will be arguing this issue before the Supreme Court.
Let's hope not as a defendant. But
hey, listen, Dan, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It was a great conversation. Hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Absolutely, Cam. I'd love to.
All right. Thank you so much. Dan Hagen joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My thanks to Dan for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again soon. Let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report will start there with a case out of California. DA charges man with fatal shooting in Huntington Beach. So it turns out the man who was charged, quite well known to law enforcement in the Los Angeles area. Luis Angel Morales, accused of killing 42-year-old Ryan Daniel Innes of Anaheim back on Sunday. Morales is 28 years old. He has quite the criminal history. He's got pending cases for possessing a deadly weapon and illegal substance in jail, as well as manufacturing a deadly weapon in custody, all of which are felonies. He'd been released from jail on October 17th. He's also facing a felony count of stalking with a restraining order, which is another felony, and a misdemeanor count of reckless driving. In a probation violation petition that was filed back in June, he was accused of sending a woman pictures of guns. Last year, in October, he pleaded guilty to fleeing police and reckless driving. He was on probation in that case until September of next year. But according to that June probation violation petition, he also has a prior criminal history of illegally possessing firearms, ammunition, and promoting a gang. He has now been charged with murder with a sentencing enhancement of discharge of a gun causing death, which is one of those stupid laws in California. Just charge somebody with murder, for God's sakes. I mean, you've got such a weird system in California where they look for opportunities to go light on violent criminals and then they have all of these, you know, sort of enhancements rather than just getting tough on violent actors in the first place. Anyway, Mr. Morales, lots of opportunities to keep him behind bars, but nope, he was out on the street and again allegedly responsible for the death of 42-year-old Ryan Daniel Innes in Anaheim last weekend. Today's armed citizen story from Raleigh, North Carolina, where police say a homeowner shot a man during a burglary in the southeast side of the city. Beautiful city, by the way. I spent my birthday weekend in Raleigh, and thankfully did not run into any trouble, unlike the homeowner there. Shooting happened around midnight, I believe, on Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning. Raleigh police arrived at the scene. They found 26-year-old Christian Beasley with a gunshot wound. Homeowner spoke to a WRAL News, said he was in the bathroom getting ready for bed when he heard somebody kicking his door. When he walked into his living room, he saw Beasley standing there. He said, "I had my gun. I was telling him, get down, or get out." And then he just ran to me, which is when the homeowner fired shots. The homeowner said he had no choice but to defend himself and their home. He says, if somebody breaks into your home, actually, the homeowner's wife said, if somebody breaks into your home, you have to protect yourself. And that's what he did. He had to protect us. We did not know what he was going to do. Beasley taken to a trauma center. He is expected to survive his injuries. He will be processed on charges of first-degree burglary and damage to property when he's released from the hospital. Police say that the homeowner is not facing any charges at this time, given the self-defense nature of the shooting, but we'll keep our eyes open for any more details. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Some kids in Indiana who saved their neighbor from a house fire. This was over the weekend. In Blackford County, Indiana, Nina Osgood has been looking after these kids for about 12 years while their mom, Keisha Gerber, goes to work. She has long, odd hours, so Osgood offered to step in and help the family. Gerber said she's amazing. She'd give the shirt off her back. She does everything for me and my kids. And so it was Sunday afternoon. The kids in question noticed flames coming out of one of Osgood's windows. 9-year-old Brianna Fields saw the smoke from her kitchen. She called over her 11-year-old brother, Reese. Her 8-year-old cousin, Grant Cosner, and the three of them ran over to Osgood's home, ran in through the back door, shook Nina Osgood awake. Reese said it was black smoke rolling in when Nina was coming out, so she was like coughing. Nina Osgood said they say in about 15 more minutes she would have been, I would have been dead, she said. So they were little heroes. The home, unfortunately, damaged. I don't know if it's declared a total loss, but unlivable. Nina Osgood, however, has been able to find a new place to live since then with the help of family in the Blackford community. But alive and well because of the kids that she cares for, caring for her. Those kids, today's hero of the day. That's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again next Monday. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com between now and then. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest segment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. You've got hours left to use the promo code POTUS47 and take 74% off of your VIP membership, no matter what level of support you choose. There are great benefits involved, but at every level, you are supporting the work we're doing here at Bearing Arms, and I certainly do appreciate that. Have a great rest of your week, a wonderful weekend as well. We'll see you back here on Monday with another edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.